Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again with our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. Again, another fun week. I really enjoyed doing this podcast. I think I enjoy it more and more every week. And very privileged and humbled to have reached an audience globally that never imagined when I started doing this just a little over a year ago. So I've really enjoyed speaking with a lot of you guys via text, via email, calling me, and I will give all that contact information out over the phone. I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of you guys from various parts of not only the United States, but other parts of the world who are coming to see me for neuropsych evals, which is just truly amazing and incredibly humbling. So thank you to all of you guys who follow this program, and I appreciate all the positive comments. Some people comment on the audio. Look, that wasn't part of my doctoral training, so I do the best I can with the equipment I have, which is pretty good. So I do this very organically. Julie is around, whether she pops in or not. She kind of ebbs and flows in the ether, and if she jumps in, she'll jump in. So I had thought of different topics I wanted to cover, which is something I generally don't do during the week. But I interestingly, this week was one of the topics I've been talking about the most. And I woke up to probably 70 emails and 50 texts and several voicemails asking me to revisit borderline personality disorder. And I'm going to try and touch on probably the people wanted, I think people, new people who joined the show or just wanted a refresher on it. Hopefully I'll be able to cover topics that I didn't cover in other topics or other episodes, but I will do my best. But I want to backtrack from the whole concept of personality. And personality, if you break it down, is it's my belief about myself, my belief about other people, my belief about the world in general, and the therefores, the conclusions that I draw based on those beliefs. Again, a cognitive model, and why I am a staunch proponent of cognitive behavioral therapy versus dialectical behavioral therapy or ACT, acceptance commitment therapy. That's, again, this is just my own personal perspective and the way I was trained and looking at the data. And as a scientist practitioner, I rely on data, I rely on research, I rely on clinical models, and I've seen the efficacy. And that's in a really important part of, I think, one, not only being a diagnostician, which is my primary role, but also in doing any type of clinical work, whether that's through assessment and through clinical interviewing, which I talked last week that I think Julie and I were talking earlier, like maybe walk you guys through the process of like how I approach being able to kind of, you know, what questions that I would ask you and what questions that you want to make sure are answered and covered as you work with your individual clinician. So if you take that heuristic of I am, others are, the world is, from a borderline perspective. And again, revisiting this because something I'm really trying to do with this specific disorder is destigmatize it because it has such a negative connotation. I remember I got one email and the person's been looking for a therapist and the number of therapists the term they use, and I think we hear it all the time, is they say they've had this, they have this diagnosis and every therapist runs for the hills. And that's very common when people hear borderline personality. And I can speculate as to why I think that might be. I think it's because many mental health practitioners don't understand personality disorders, don't understand personality theory, learning theory, attachment theory, behavioral psychology, the empirical evidence behind it. And that's why this is a disorder that you have to be with somebody who knows how to treat it. It has to be somebody who is it's a chronic condition. But I've said this before, and I'll say it again with 100% belief and passion that this is a disorder that is not only treatable, it is curable, but it takes work. So the borderline heuristic is I am unstable. Other people dictate my sense of self, my sense of self-worth, my sense of self-esteem, my identity. The world is a cruel, unpredictable place that will hurt me, that will leave me, that will abandon me. Therefore, I will do whatever, whenever, however, whether it transcends my better judgment, my upbringing, my values, my morals, societal standards, whatever, in order to stave off any sense of perceived or real imagined abandonment. And that's the cornerstone of borderline pathology, is that intense fear of real or imagined abandonment. Now, people have asked, is personality inherited? No. Personality is learned. Temperament is inherited. Temperament is our biological predisposition to reactivity. So two people can perceive a similar situation. One responds, the other doesn't. That's pathophysiological. That's biologically based. From a psychiatric perspective, you got to go back to the work of John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth and their look in terms of attachment theory. And I'm going to break it down very simplistically because they have all these other ones that have come up and, you know, people come up with all these different terms. But you basically have what are called secure attachments and insecure attachments. And secure attachments, and this goes back to the work even of Jean Piaget in his work, and he studied his own kids, but he came up with a model, and it's something that I did my dissertation on in terms of this cognitive model of reasoning, where we have sensory motor, pre-operational, concrete operational, formal operational. But he also focused a lot on object permanence. And object permanence is, you know, if mom leaves the room and I don't freak out, I have a secure attachment because I know mom's coming back. If mom leaves the room and I freak out, I have an insecure attachment because I believe mom leaves. As kids grow older, they extrapolate that to, well, if mom leaves, that means that dad can leave, my brothers can leave, my cousins can leave, my significant others can leave. So attachment theory plays a significant role, and insecure attachments are really at the cornerstone of the ontogenesis or etiology of borderline pathology. And I would even venture to say that overly secure attachments can also lead to the development of etiology of borderline personality. And here's what I mean by that. If you have overly secure attachments to your parental figures, whether that's, you know, biological parents, step-parents, grandparents who raise you at early developmentally formative years, then overly secure attachment, you feel this such, you're almost basking in the sense of safety that in other relationships, if that person doesn't give you that same degree or intensity of security, that could also result in the manifestation of borderline personality pathology, because this is really all about attachments. It's about in insecurity. Again, personality is not inherited, and is there in my experience, a lot of times when I'm doing my structured diagnostic clinical interview and borderline personality is on the table as a possible differential diagnosis, people will often allude to a family member, many times a parent, or a very proximal relative that had a personality disorder. So I think there's definitely a learning component involved in this, but this is a relational disorder. This is one that manifests in interpersonal relationships, and it does have a lot of comorbidity, which means other disorders are coexisting. Often anxiety, depression, PTSD, OCD, possibly schizophrenia, and bipolarity. And there's so much symptom overlap between bipolarity and borderline personality. And again, I probably say this every episode. The only way to really know what it is to get a full neuropsych eval, because borderline presents itself in 120 different ways, because there's 5 to 9 diagnostic criteria you have to meet. And 5 times, 4 times, 3 times, 2 times, 1 is 120. Another person recently texted me, I think today, should he tell his significant other that he believes she has borderline personality? And my response was a resounding no. Do not tell anybody that you think they have not only a personality disorder, but don't tell them they have bipolar. You maybe say, I think you have some depression, maybe anxiety, but this is where that stigma of borderline comes in, because there's this, again, I think it goes back to the other person who said, you know, all these therapists, they want to run for the hills. I don't know why that is. But I think, again, as somebody who focuses and specializes in treating this disorder, again, not doing a lot of therapy, but being very well trained, it's really understanding, you know, all the dynamics. And when you're working with kids and adolescents, you know, for a variety of disorders, whether that's borderline, depression, anxiety, obsessive defiant disorder, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. You know, a lot of the work when you're dealing with kids is incumbent upon the parents. It's incumbent upon those who are giving the environmental responses to problematic behaviors. So that's, I think, a separate topic in and of itself when we talk about, you know, what do you do as a parent with a child with a personality disorder? And I've said this multiple times, nowhere in the diagnostic manual does it say, with the exception of antisocial personality disorder, that you cannot diagnose a personality disorder prior to age 18. And the reason for that is because it's not a clinical issue. It's a legal issue, because at age 18, you could be tried as an adult for problematic behaviors that violate societal norms. Prior to that, it's conduct disorder. So again, I think it's a disservice to not diagnose something. And if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a duck. And I think, you know, I've used the analogy like, well, you know, I tested your blood, your A1C is 12, but I'm not going to tell you that you have diabetes because you're not at a certain age. That just makes like absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. When I have the data in front of me from the testing, from the MMPI, from all the different various rating scales, all my data from my structured diagnostic clinical interview, all the historical background information, the Rorschach, the TAT, I have all that, and it confirms like this is borderline. I think I would be doing an incredible disservice to an individual by not telling them, or if it's a child or adolescent, telling their parents that this is what's going on. Early treatment, early intervention leads to much better outcomes. So when you get to a pharmacological standpoint, this often presents as bipolarity. And again, there's a huge misunderstanding with bipolarity that they think people are moody, that they have mood swings. That is not bipolar at all. It's a transition into an alternative mood state that is neurochemically driven. That is a disorder in terms of, I'm talking about bipolarity, that is a disorder that requires medication. Are there individuals who can function without bipolar without medication? I'm sure there are. A vast majority of people benefit from the mood stabilizers. Lithium, Lamictal, Latuda, Vraylar, Trileptal, a variety of medications to help stabilize the mood. So this is where the diagnostic piece from testing is really able to delineate one, the other, or both. So, you know, what do you do if you're in a relationship with somebody because with borderline personality disorder? Do you run for the hills? There are people that do that. Do you stay in the muck and the mire? Yeah, people do that. Do you almost, people also, again, of working with just a vast number of people, they love the individual, but it's the volatility of the emotional dysregulation. And I think that's where people get confused with DBT, because DBT focuses so much on emotion. When you're looking at the brain, The limbic system, the amygdala, those are the structures of the brain that control emotional regulation. If you're coming from a cognitive behavior perspective, you're looking at changing the actual structural integrity of the brain by learning and growing new neuronal connections by a process called neuroplasticity. And this is only within the last several years, because we were always trained and taught that the brain is born, we're born with a finite amount of neuronal connections. The ones we use become reinforced, over-enhanced. The sodium, potassium, and ion channels, they're going back and forth. The myelin sheath, which is the insulation between within the axon hillock, which is kind of the engine that stimulates the depolarization of the cell. You know, when you're over rehearsing these thoughts, these things become, you think about going to like going to the gym. The more bicep curls you do, your biceps are invariably going to get bigger. So the more you think, I am unstable, I am unworthy, I am unhealthy, I need other people, I can't live myself, I can't live in my own skin, that becomes over rehearsed. And those neuronal connections are incredibly strong. So, I guess the terminology I would use is, you're from a cognitive behavioral perspective, you're helping a person to divorce themselves from those thoughts. As you start to grow new, start to think differently, think of it as like little buds, little seedlings. And you have these really strong neuronal connections that give all that negative self-talk. And now you start to say, well, I think I'm a good person. Those are little seedlings, and they get overtaken by the neuronal pathways that are perpetuating the cognitive structure of borderline pathology. So it's learning a new way of thinking. And as you learn a new way of thinking through the process of neuroplasticity, and the brain is growing new neuronal connections, and the other ones, if you're not using those other thought patterns, they're not becoming oxygenated. The decreased blood flow, the oxygenation and the blood flow is now going to these new healthier patterns of thinking. And if you, it's kind of like the use it or lose it philosophy. So as you start to use these new ways of thinking, the older ways start to dissipate. And it doesn't mean it dissipates overnight, and that's why I always talk about celebrating partial victories, because the old ways, the old demons, the old mindsets are very powerful because they are very ingrained. And through a process of cognitive disputation, cognitive restructuring, the cognitive therapy models, they're focusing on the cognitions, because the thoughts are what are driving borderline pathology. People, what you see is the emotional dysregulation. That's what you see. You see the screaming. You see the crying. You see the, I'm going to kill myself. You see the, I'm going to, if you leave me, I'm going to cut myself. I'm going to kill myself. And that's what keeps people in relationships, because like, oh my God, if I leave, he or she's going to kill themselves. So I better stay. So these are hard relationships to get out of, but people with borderline personality are in an incredible amount of pain. They don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to get out of their own way, because they are so dependent on other people. And again, this is I use dependency not in conjunction or association with dependent personality disorder. I'm using it from the perspective of they are dependent, almost like a food source, almost like a water stream, that without that affirmation from other people, they don't know how to survive. They're in constant psychological survival mode. And I've talked in episodes about needs and wants. This is a thing where I think needs is really very much part of what the borderline individual is operating on. They need that. Let me put it this way. They perceive or believe that they need that. They can't get out of their own way to see that they can be a different version of themselves. This is an incredibly exhausting disorder, not only for the individual, but for people who are in relationship with them, be it a parent, a sibling, a significant other, a spouse, a grandparent. Sometimes I've heard clinicians refer to people with borderline as energy vampires. Again, that's focusing so much on the emotional part. From the cognitive behavioral part, we're focusing changing your thoughts and changing your behaviors, and the emotions will change. And people will disagree and say, "Oh, you're so much of a, you're so rigid with cognitive therapy." You know what? Yes, you know what? I am, because it works. Because the data has shown it consistently over and over and over again. Going and talking about your feelings, great. What does that do? It just helps you learn how to regulate your emotions. It doesn't change how you think. It doesn't change how you behave. It just gives you tools that when you're emotionally dysregulated, what to do with it. So that's why I Julie and I disagree on the CBT versus DBT model. And, you know, you can listen to that episode where we disagree and argue, and people are like, "Oh, you shouldn't disagree and argue." But that's how this whole field developed. That's how this whole field evolves, is because people disagreed. Adler disagreed with Freud. He was shunned. But Adler was the precursor to cognitive behavioral therapy. So healthy dissent, healthy disagreement, I think is very good in any kind of discipline where there isn't definitive answers or specific certainty with things. So, you know, it really goes back to attachment. It really goes back to looking, you know, can you undo the past? No. But the past, I think, is important to give context. It's important to understand where did this come from. But to go back and fix the past, you know, the Wayne Dyer metaphor I've used of the wake of the boat, there's a reason that, you know, his other metaphors, there's a reason that the rearview mirror is smaller than the windshield, because we have to focus on where we're going. And if you are in relationship with somebody with borderline personality, it is not your job to fix them. Is it your responsibility to maybe help them? Yes, to encourage them, drive them to a therapy appointment, motivate them, drive them to their med appointment. Absolutely. You know, provided we're, you know, reasonably sound, decent human beings. I think most people are. But, you know, the overarching theme of all these emails and phone calls and text messages is like, what do I do? And I my job is not to tell anybody what to do. My job is not to say, well, I think you should leave him or her, or I think you should say. My question would be is, what do you want, and why do you want it? And what are you hoping for? But until the person gets to a place of saying, you know what, I'm uncomfortable and I'm tired of thinking, feeling, and acting this way, take any psychiatric condition, you're not going to change. You are not going to change. No one's going to change until they get to be to that state of discomfort. So, you know, borderline is something that, you know, Julie comes across a lot from a medication perspective. Like I said, it's medicated very much like bipolarity, but there is no medication for personality. This is a therapeutic issue. And this is a therapeutic issue that really, and many times it involves multiple people, like almost like a family systems model, where you have, you know, I think that one major thing, especially when working with like adolescents, is I do a lot of psychoeducation when I do the feedback session with parents about what this is. And when you talk about it being, you know, personality being developed in early childhood, I can see it on parents' faces that they internalized, like, I did something wrong. You know, I screwed up. And it's really important that, you know, I'm taking just like your typical family. I'm not talking about exogenous factors where there may have been sexual abuse or physical abuse and stuff like that. But, you know, if you're a parent and your child has this disorder, you know, stop blaming yourself and become part of the treatment team and treatment process. Another person asked, you know, how is substance abuse related to borderline pathology? And I think there is a high comorbidity of misuse of substances, alcohol, marijuana being probably the two biggest ones. I think sometimes you see when, you know, people are getting into like LSD, mushrooms, cocaine, crack, invariably what you see is a lot of times it's, I want to fit in. And that fitting in is part of that being a chameleon, where your person is engaging those behaviors that transcends better judgment. Like, hey, I didn't wake up this morning wanting to do LSD, but I'm out with this guy and I really like him and I think he likes me. But if I don't do LSD, even though I was raised in a very strict Catholic household, oh my God, what am I going to do if I don't do it? I better do it. That's where you see that that disconnect from, you know, what the prototypical or what their, I hate the term normal, but what their general response would be if they weren't presented with that opportunity to engage in that behavior. So, you know, substance abuse is very much related to, with borderline, to self-medicating. I think it's related to self-medicating to numb the feelings that are way too powerful, way too painful to confront, the negative thoughts, and even the transient psychotic symptoms that are not part of the psychotic disorders, but you know, symptoms of feelings of unreality, hallucinations under times of distress, delusional thinking. That is the ninth I think that's number nine of all the diagnostic criteria. Again, doesn't mean that's the least severe. It's just that that's how it's ordered in the ordered numerically in the diagnostic manual. So yes, there is a lot of comorbidity with substance use and misuse and abuse, but I think it's twofold. It's one, it's self-medicating, and two, it's also being able to fit or perceived fitting into whatever culture or individual that they are in relationship with. But so there's multiple layers to this, and you know, the whole dual diagnosis model, I have a different perspective on it. If someone's using substances, a lot of times they're going to go, a lot of clinicians will go right to focusing on decreasing the substance abuse. I'm not condoning it, but that's all the person has. If you're using substances, but you're not doing anything like, well, you're not journaling, you're not, you know, thought stopping, you're not doing all that stuff like that, I focus primarily on treating the primary psychiatric condition, because the substance use, yes, concerning, absolutely diagnosable, absolutely warrants attention, but I believe in a different perspective of focusing more on the mental health piece, that if we can get better control over that, whether that's through medication, if it's medications like psychiatric medications like Vivitrol or Naltrexone or Campril, you know, there are medications that can help in decreasing cravings and usage of you know, alcohol. But so I hope I'm making sense by saying it's really a twofold process: one of self-medicating, and two of being part of the culture, whether that's part of a group or part of just being in that individual's life, that where a person with borderline perceives that they have that strong attachment to it. Again, borderline is I love you, I hate you. We call them the mercurial styles. It's a dysregulated thermometer, but the mercury is in there. That's why it's treatable. Versus the narcissist, it's a nice looking thermometer, probably the prettiest one you've ever seen, but there's no mercury in there whatsoever. That's why you have nothing to work with when you treat the narcissist. Similar to some extent with the histrionic, there's a little bit of mercury in there. The goal is to, you know, add some mercury. But as you know, mercury is dangerous. It's poisonous. It's toxic. But in the borderline, it's contained. The goal is to just recalibrate it and re-regulate it. So it's a disorder that has a lot of misunderstanding, has a lot of really negative connotations associated with it. I mean, calling somebody borderline is, I strongly recommend you don't do that. But I definitely recommend, if you are in relationship, being involved in the therapeutic process of working with the individual, as given and provided that they are actively engaged in wanting to change, that they are actively engaged in wanting to say, I'm tired of thinking, acting, and feeling this way. So, you know, sometimes does it require inpatient treatment? Yeah, it does. Sometimes does it require, what we call like IOPs or partial programs? Yeah, it does, especially for children and adolescents. But this is a disorder that does not get treated in a week, a month, or a year. It takes time. And again, I completely respect people who say, look, I don't want to be, I don't, I'm your husband, I'm your wife, I'm your partner, whatever. I don't know if I can be on board for this ride. You have that right. You are not responsible, but always pay attention to your motivation. These are individuals who are in an incredible amount of pain that stems back from early childhood. And, you know, we can't undo what has been done. Can people overcome it? Absolutely. But you cannot want it more than they do. You cannot want anything more than someone else does. You have to do the work. You have to have the energy. You have to have the passion. And if you're walking out of your therapy sessions and you're feeling good, if you have borderline personality and you're feeling like, oh, that was easy, you're not. That's not the right therapy. You should be walking out bewildered, confused, analyzing your thoughts, being like, you know what? I need to check myself. If you're doing more talking than your therapist, you're not getting the right therapy. You should be given, you know, ask your therapist for very specific goals to work on, very specific techniques. X always causes Y. The Y is easy to identify. That's the cutting. That's the screaming. That's the I hate you. That's the I love you. That's the, you want to always get to the X. What was happening prior to that? And pay attention to the cognitions and the resulting behaviors prior and after. Data collection is a huge part of doing psychotherapy, not just going in every week and talking about how your week was. That's called friendship. That's not called therapy. So I just, again, in response to just the vast audience that we have, I wanted to just revisit this. Hopefully you guys learned some new things that I may have not brought up in other topics, but I would definitely encourage you to look up the work of John Bowlby, Mary Ainsworth, and their work in attachment theory. I would definitely encourage you to look up the work of Jean Piaget and his work on object permanence to gain better insight and understanding, because these are cornerstone and salient features in this specific pathology. Don't get so hung up on CBT versus DBT versus ACT versus mindfulness. Get a better understanding of personality theory and personality development and really attachment and attachment styles. And as always, you can reach out to me, as many of you have. I'm passionate about what I do. I appreciate a lot of you guys who email, text, call me, that the passion comes across. I do these organically off the top of my head. I think the only notes I made were the ones on the cognitive distortions, just so I make sure I covered them all. But again, I think this is a topic we will continue to revisit, as I'm doing my best to demystify it, instill a sense of hope, instill a sense of integrity to the severity of it, the legitimacy of it, but really trying to destigmatize it, because it's a very misunderstood diagnosis, and it's one that impacts not only the individual, but it impacts everybody in relationship with that individual. So until next week, feel free to reach out to me at psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. You can get a hold of me through Psychology Today. My direct cell phone number is 617-750-9411, East Coast Standard Time. I am more than happy to do whatever I can. I always say this is my modest version of God's work, to share the knowledge I have. I'm a perpetual student. And again, it's humbling, and it's very privileged to have grown such an audience and to be able to do something that reaches a global audience. And it's inspiring. It's motivating for me. I look forward to Sundays when I do this. And feel free to email me topics. You know, like attachment theories is a whole topic in and of itself. Substance abuses, growing up with a parent with a personality disorder is. So I wanted to at least touch on some of the things that you guys have mentioned. But I am here for you in any way that I possibly can. And Julie is always available for me to get in contact with, you know, for consults and stuff like that. But be empowered. We as individuals have a lot more control and strength than we really think we do, whether that's borderline, whether that's depression, whether it's anxiety, Whatever it is, it's what you have. It is not what you are. Until next week, everyone, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Look forward to it. I will talk to you then. Bye, guys.